Communists dominated the leadership of the Miners' Federation, the Waterside Workers' Federation and the Seamen's Union, and were an influential force in numerous other trade unions. A decade before, the party's profile had grown through its determined efforts to organise unemployed workers during the Great Depression. In the intervening years, communists had emerged at the forefront of major industrial battles, particularly in the mines and on the waterfront. Yet in the years 1941 to 1945, the CPA adopted a position of unqualified support for this Australian war effort led by the Labor Prime Minister, John Curtin. Communist union officials were appointed to industry commissions and readily performed their assigned tasks, avoiding strikes, disciplining militants, and maximising wartime production. Simultaneously, the party urged its members to enlist in the armed forces. The CPA's cheerleading of the Curtin government's war effort was in fact the third phase in a series of zigzags that echoed Stalin's foreign policy in the lead up to and during World War II. From the mid-1930s, the Communist International, which I'll refer to here as the Comintern, dictated that working class interests were to be subordinated to the needs of progressive capitalists who opposed fascism. However, after Stalin signed a peace treaty with Hitler in August 1939, a new line emerged. The CPA now denounced the inter-imperialist war, and this position lasted until June 1941, when Hitler launched a major military offensive against the Soviet Union. Under Moscow's orders, the CPA did another U-turn. The imperialist war now became a people's war to defeat fascism. As party president Lance Sharkey put it, Hitler's invasion of the USSR changed the character of the war into a war of independence on the part of democratic peoples against fascist imperialist aggression. Well, why did the CPA support its own bourgeoisie in waging war in defence of the imperial interests of Australia, Britain and the United States? This talk will examine the twists and turns of the party's policy and its impact on working class politics. It'll be argued that throughout the war, the Communist Party acted as an instrument of Stalin's foreign policy. A decade earlier, in 1929, the Comintern had imposed a new leadership on the party, which destroyed the party's internal democracy and ensured Moscow's command over party policy. During the 1930s and again during post-war strike wave, many communists, both leaders and rank-and-file members, led important political and industrial struggles. However, at a time of deep crisis, culminating in a world war between imperialist powers, it was to Stalin's men in Moscow that the party leadership turned. As a consequence, the CPA departed from the practice of revolutionary Marxism and pursued a policy of class collaboration, subordinating the interests of Australian workers to Curtin's imperialist war effort. In the mid-1930s, after the coming to power of the Nazis in Germany and the destruction of the German Communist Party, the KPD, which at the time was the largest Communist Party outside the Soviet Union, Stalin abandoned the ultra-left third period line, which had branded Labour and Social Democratic parties as social fascist. Under a new popular front policy, the main enemy was now fascism, and all other questions became secondary. Addressing the Comintern's Seventh Congress in 1935, Dimitrov, who appears in the slide there, said, "In the present concrete international situation, the instigator of the approaching war is fascism, this mailed fist of the most aggressive forces of imperialism. It's completely wrong," he argued, "to predict all countries as aggressors at the present." Prior to the mid-1930s, the CPA had maintained the line that war was caused by capitalism and was used to turn workers of the imperialist nations against each other. The party argued that the working class should agitate to turn an imperialist war into a civil war, with soldiers turning their guns on their officers. As the party's Victorian secretary, Ralph Gibson, told an audience in Melbourne in 1933, "When we are called on to fight for king and country, we are called on to follow our enemies and shoot our friends." However, under the new logic of the Popular Front, Stalin attempted to court an alliance with Germany's main imperial rivals, Britain and France, in the name of collective security. In 1934, the Soviet Union joined the League of Nations, a club of the victorious powers of World War One, and in 1935, the Franco-Soviet Pact was signed in Moscow, an alliance between the USSR and France. Simultaneously, the Comintern directed its affiliate communist parties to pursue a united front of the labour movement from above and below through both formal agreements with bourgeois and working class parties opposed to fascism and by working with non-communists to build front organisations. In Europe, this approach led to communists joining and defending bourgeois governments led by social democratic parties with disastrous consequences. In France, the Popular Front government collapsed under its contradictions, giving rise to the Vichy regime that collaborated with Nazi Germany. In Spain, the Communist Party disarmed and repressed anti-fascist militia, not under the control of the Republican government, hastening the victory of Franco's nationalist forces. The CPA's Popular Front turn meant an about-face in its orientation to the Australian Labor Party, which it now sought to affiliate with, and increasingly an adaptation to Labor nationalism. This policy was pursued cautiously at first. Rebuffed by federal Labor, the CPA set about building Popular Front organisations. One of these was the Movement Against War and Fascism, initiated in 1933. Morph was given a boost by the visit of Czech writer and left-wing journalist Egon Kish, who defied Attorney General Robert Menzies' ban on his participation in Morph's anti-war congress by jumping from his ship's deck onto the Port Melbourne wharf. Kitch broke his leg and captured news headlines. When Kitch was arrested and directed to take a dictation test in Gaelic, as was made possible by the White Australia policy of the time, a storm of protest erupted, leading to a successful High Court appeal that overturned his ban. Now an anti-fascist cause celebre, Kitch addressed a crowd of 18,000 in the Sydney Domain and many thousands more on an East Coast speaking tour. Between 1939, the CPA built the Spanish Relief Fund, which rallied support for Spain's Popular Front government. However, the fall of Barcelona to Franco's nationalist forces in January 1939 sealed not only the fate of the Republican government, but also attempts to build Popular Fronts from below. Appeals for unity of the labour movement were increasingly overshadowed by Stalin's determination to secure an alliance with Britain at all costs. The CPA played its part in rallying patriots behind the British flag. In 1937, a CPA election leaflet warned of the danger to the British Empire posed by fascism. At the same time, the CPA enthusiastically campaigned for a Labor victory, arguing that the Conservative Lyons government was not doing enough to prepare the country for war. Too small to pressure Labor into a formal agreement, the CPA instead argued that the ALP should form a government in alliance with middle-class and capitalist parties. In September 1938, Assistant Secretary Richard Dixon outlined what a Popular Front in Australia might look like. He said, "It will consist of the Labor Party, which is the mass political organisation of the working class. It must cover organisations of farmers, including groups in the Country Party, which are in opposition to the reactionary groups which betray farmers. It will need to embrace the middle classes in the cities and towns and their organisations, and also groups in the United Australia Party who are discontented with the Lyons-Menzies leadership." If you were to imagine that in today's terms, imagine calling for Labor Party to take government alongside Malcolm Turnbull and Julie Bishop and Liberals, smaller Liberals from the Liberal Party. The political implications of the CPA's Popular Front policy were adrift towards parliamentarism and support for a policy of national self-defence. In 1938, at its 12th conference, the party changed its name to the Australian Communist Party and adopted a new constitution that buried any revolutionary pretensions. Although it was called the ACP at this point, I'm going to continue to refer to it, the party, as the CPA. Sharkey made clear that the party now favoured a parliamentary road to socialism, stating that the constitution champions Australian democracy and declares its faith that the majority of the Australian people can be won to the great change from capitalism to socialism through democratic means. The movement against war and fascism was now renamed the Australian League for Peace and Freedom, and its journal War What For, which had echoed a slogan of the Wobblies, adopted the masthead World Peace. The party's national paper, Workers Weekly, became Tribune, the people's paper, shorn of its hammer and sickle. The changes were not merely symbolic. The party's propaganda became infused with a stridently nationalist tone. In a January 1939 Communist Review article, Tribune editor Harry Gould argued that the working class were not only the most consistent champions of democracy, but also the only consistent champions of patriotism. Rejecting the Leninist policy of transforming the imperialist war into a civil war, Gould argued that an armed struggle against an invasion by Japanese fascism, even if led by capitalists, should be a democratic struggle, one which workers would support and presumably should support. With no brief from Moscow to guide it, the Communist Party responded to the outbreak of the war by calling for the victory of the democratic powers against fascism and urging the dispatch of an Australian expeditionary force to Europe. However, the CPA failed to anticipate a new turn in Stalin's foreign policy. In August 1939, Stalin signed a non-aggression treaty with Hitler that enabled the pair to divide Poland between them and paved the way for the USSR to seize the Baltic states the following year. It's a comic that you can see there on the screen with Hitler and Stalin standing over the corpse of Poland. The CPA swiftly shifted tack under orders from Moscow. After having championed a people's war against fascism, the party now loudly denounced the inter-imperialist war. Moscow's plan for collective security no longer rested on protection from Britain, but a tenuous pact with the Axis powers. In February 1940, Dixon, party leader, spelt out the new line. Loyalty to our class transcends all other loyalties. The fight of the working class is against the enemy in Australia and not outside. We must make it perfectly clear that the issue confronting the working class today is not bourgeois democracy or fascism, but capitalism or socialism, capitalist rule or working class rule. The party, which just months before was trumpeting its support for the British Empire, now denounced its crimes and vowed that Australian workers should not be sacrificed for Britain's war ambitions. This tone undoubtedly struck a chord with a significant section of the Australian working class, especially those with memories of the brutality of World War I. In the lead-up to the war, both British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain and Australian Prime Ministers Joseph Lyons and his successor Robert Menzies were seen as appeasers of Hitler with fascist sympathies. While on a tour of Nazi Germany in 1938, Menzies, then the Attorney General, wrote home expressing his admiration for a regime that had smashed leftist trade unions and extolled the virtues of racial superiority in order to revive the fortunes of German capitalism. In a letter to his sister, Menzies wrote, "It must be said that this modern abandonment by the Germans of individual liberty and of the easy and pleasant things of life have something rather magnificent about it. The Germans may be pulling down the churches, but they have erected the state, capital S, with Hitler as its head, into a sort of religion which produces spiritual exaltation that one cannot but admire, if you're a toff like me." Once Britain had declared war on Germany on September 3, 1939, Menzies declared Australia also to be at war. However, his efforts to impose wartime discipline on the labour movement at home were not warmly received and in some cases faced stiff resistance. In March 1940, the New South Wales Labour Conference declared its support for an immediate end to hostilities. A similar resolution moved by the leader of the FIA and communist Ernie Thornton at the ACTU Congress the following month failed by just two votes. Increased military production also provided for an opportunity for workers to advance claims through strike action. In March 1940, coal miners won a 40-hour week after a two-month strike. Waterside workers followed suit, defying a decision of the arbitration court. The party's strident support for the Stalin-Hitler Pact provided Menzies with a pretext for a wartime ban on the party's publications. and soon the party itself, on the grounds that it was collaborating with the enemy. In June 1940, federal police raided party offices and members' homes, seizing allegedly seditious material and driving the leadership underground. Yet the party emerged well prepared, continuing to organise through its underground and front organisations. In the September 1940 federal election and the March 1941 Queensland state election, party candidates won thousands of votes. And in May 1941, when two communists, Horace Ratliff and Max Thomas, were jailed for printing anti-war leaflets, 50,000 workers in communist-led unions struck. Their cause tapped into a wider sentiment of opposition to Menzies' attacks on civil liberties. There was, however, nothing internationalist about the CPA's newfound anti-imperialism. The party defended Stalin's occupation of territory in Finland, Poland, and Romania as a policy of self-defence. Some quit the party in disgust, others were expelled. The CPA's left turn lasted until June 1941, when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union. And this map illustrates the scale of that offensive. Over the following 4 months, the Nazis overran the Ukraine, taking 40,000 prisoners in Kiev and reaching the outskirts of Moscow. The rapid advance demonstrated the superior firepower of the German Reich, but also the failure of Stalin to prepare for the inevitable offensive. Desperate to slow the German onslaught, Stalin pleaded with Churchill to open a Western Front, but to no avail. Under Moscow's orders, the CPA now did another about-face. The war was no longer an imperialist war, but a patriotic war to defend the independence of oppressed peoples, a reversion back to the popular front line. The CPA enthusiastically campaigned for the election of a curtain Labour government and in October 1941 declared its wholehearted support for the new government's war effort. The party's Central Committee report to the 13th Congress enthused, "The greatest battle of all history has been joined. The battle of darkness against light, night against day, death against life. To achieve this victory, every nerve must be strained, all else must be subordinated." Though there was disquiet within party ranks about the dramatic shift, a number of factors aligned to make it easier for the Communist Party leaders to win support for their new line. Firstly, Curtin had been an anti-conscription activist in World War I, and unlike Menzies, was not tainted by fascist sympathies. Consequently, a Labor government enjoyed considerably more working-class support. Secondly, Japan's bombing of Pearl Harbor in December 1941, its rapid advance through Southeast Asia, and its bombing of northern Australian towns assisted Curtin to stoke fear of an imminent Japanese invasion. In the context of white Australia, talk of the yellow peril connected with deeply entrenched racism. Thirdly, despite the brutality of the Moscow trials and Stalin's gulags, the Soviet Union enjoyed substantial support amongst Australian workers. It was perceived as representing a departure from the ills of capitalism, and its defiant and ultimately successful defeat of German fascism was eulogised as an example of self-sacrifice. Well, I think at this point it's worth saying something about what position socialists should take on World War II. The World War II Allied war effort is often celebrated as a good war, a war for democracy, contrasted with a tragic waste of human life on the European battlefields of World War I. This myth, perpetuated by much of the left, asserts that national unity was needed to overcome the fascist and militarist threats of the Axis powers. However, the Allied powers showed little regard for democracy. Britain and France each possessed vast colonial empires, denying their subjects the right to self-determination. Immediately after the war, independence uprisings were brutally suppressed in countries such as India, Indonesia, and Vietnam. Stalin, hailed as a liberator, had taken possession of Poland and the Baltic states at the beginning of the war, and by the war's end, the Soviet Union's occupation of other Eastern European states showed scant regard for national self-determination. The fascist sympathies expressed by British and Australian ruling class figures have already been addressed. During the Spanish Civil War, the Allied powers imposed an arms embargo on the Spanish Republic, enabling Franco and his fascist generals to crush Republican resistance and impose a fascist military dictatorship. World War II, therefore, was not a war to defeat democracy, sorry, to defeat fascism and save democracy. Rather, it resulted from the same contradictions that produced the Great War, rising tensions between imperialist powers exacerbated by the Great Depression. With the collapse of world trade in the 1930s, the dominant British and French ruling classes attempted to protect their weakened economies by raising trade barriers, forcing their competitors, Germany and Japan, to seize territory to gain access to raw materials and new markets. The Australian ruling class, which had long tied its fortunes to the British Empire, had valuable colonial possessions of its own to protect, such as the territories of New Guinea, Nauru and Fiji, all of which remained under colonial rule for decades after the war, enabling the plunder of their natural resources. Thus, when Japanese forces rapidly advanced through Southeast Asia, the Curtin government invoked a fear of a Japanese invasion to justify its entry into the Pacific War, even when intelligence reports provided evidence to the contrary. Curtin now pushed through Parliament the Defence Citizens Military Forces Act of 1943, allowing for conscription of Australian troops to serve in the Southwest Pacific Zone. And General Douglas MacArthur was invited to establish the US military's Southwest Pacific Area Command headquarters in Brisbane on Australian soil. By October 1941, when Curtin took office, the Communist Party had turned to jingoistic nationalism in its support for the Australian Armed Forces and urged its members to enlist. Welcoming Curtin's election, Tribune ran an editorial calling for an ever-increasing contribution by Australia in all spheres of endeavour to the Allied struggle for victory over Hitler. And I'm quoting, "Let us go to it, leading the enthusiasm for output, for recruiting and for financial sacrifice," the party's paper declared. In January 1942, a report to a Victorian Communist Party state conference declared, "The policy we are now pursuing is that in the present situation, the Communist Party becomes the leading and most active war party. In the prosecution of a just war, a people's war, it is obvious that the working class must become the leading force." The CPA supported Curtin's introduction of conscription for service outside Australia, denouncing opposition to it from liberals and Trotskyists alike. On the home front, communists worked to drum up support, sending comfort parcels to the armed forces, selling war bonds, volunteering in rural fire brigades, and mobilising labour for fruit picking and canning. And you can see here, this is the government propaganda of the era, encouraging women to enlist in the land army. 1,500 party members heeded the call to enlist, and 2,500 more were recruited from the party's work in the armed forces before the end of the war. CPA Army Cadre campaigned for increased pay and better facilities. Greater accountability of officers, the CPA argued, would help rid the armed forces of, quote, antiquated methods of training, incompetency and inefficiency. The CPA also campaigned for equal pay for servicewomen, whose pay was just two-thirds that of servicemen. These demands were raised cautiously at first. Leaflets were distributed surreptitiously as the party remained illegal until the end of 1942. Moreover, party propaganda was always framed in terms of what would most effectively aid the war effort. The aim was not to undermine military discipline, but rather to avoid unnecessary discontent or loss of morale. The party was rewarded for its enthusiastic pro-war stance with legalisation. The Menzies government's wartime ban was eased and finally lifted in December 1942, but only after the party signed an undertaking with Attorney General Bert Evatt, promising to do its utmost to promote harmony in industry, to minimise absenteeism, stoppages, strikes or other hold-ups. And that's a direct quote. The party also exalted workers to make sacrifices for the war effort, and its increasingly bureaucratic control over key industrial unions helped serve this purpose. For example, the Miners' Federation accepted cancellation of holidays, suspension of compulsory retirement and overtime to boost production. the shop committees the CPA had built in the 1930s to lead industrial struggles now served as a means to suppress such struggles. As former Communist Party member and historian Robin Golan argues, by 1945, the Miners' Federation leadership was regarded by many miners as a bureaucracy which was failing to protect the interests of miners. Wherever the trade union officials had influence, in factories, mines and on the waterfront, the party pushed to increase wartime production. Minister for Labor Eddie Ward oversaw a pact with party union officials that led to their appointment to the Commonwealth Coal Commission, the Stevedoring Industry Commission and the Maritime Industry Commission. And again, we could look at more contemporary analogies with ACTU officials such as Bill Kelty getting a seat on the Reserve Bank in the Accord era. In each case, their task was to oversee increases in wartime production and suppress strike action. In May 1942, the coal owners, the Miners' Federation and the Curtin government drafted the Canberra Code, which gave the Federation legal sanction to expel striking miners. Militants who had persisted in striking, action Curtin deemed treasonous, could be prosecuted, fined and even drafted into military service. In 1943, the Communist Waterside Workers Federation leadership rode roughshod over rank-and-file opposition in Sydney to the introduction of a rotary gang system, which they feared would result in speed-ups and longer hours. After a 3,000-strong rank-and-file stop-work meeting voted to reject the system, a 16-day strike ensued in which the Curtin government directed soldiers to scab and threatened to conscript waterside workers. So it's not just the Howard government that's used the army to bust industrial action by wharfies, but also a Curtin Labor government. Communist officials Jim Healey and Tom Nelson convened another five rank and file stop work meetings to get a return to work resolution, finally resorting to a narrowly won secret ballot to get the wharfies back to work. However, the party was not always successful in squashing industrial militancy, especially after the initial fear of a Japanese invasion had passed. At Austral Bronze in 1943, when workers struck to oppose a management speed-up scheme, communist FIA officials led strike breakers onto the job. When the engineers' union refused to work with the scabs, the strike-breaking attempt collapsed. Workers had many grievances around which to fight. While household income had increased, that came at the cost of long hours and of overtime and shift work. A heavy burden of taxation ate away at workers' pay packets, and wartime rationing limited availability of essential goods. Women workers, who were conscripted into the workforce en masse to aid wartime production, took industrial action in several industries to demand equal pay with their male counterparts. In October 1944, low-paid women workers were at the forefront of a newspaper strike that demanded a 40-hour week and 4 weeks annual leave. While the Women's Employment Bureau officially established a female pay rate at 90% of the men's wage in war-related industries, bosses avoided paying, leading to a walkout by women metal workers. Amidst the upturn in struggle, the CPA was obliged to bend the mood of workers, especially in the coal mines. From mid-1943, industrial disputation in the coal industry began to rise as militant coal miners defied their leaders' attempts to stop strikes. To remain implacably opposed to all industrial action would have seriously weakened the party's influence among industrial workers. However, when faced with a rank-and-file revolt led by Trotskyists within the Federated Iron Workers Association, the FIA, the CPA confronted its opponents head-on. Well, behind me there you can see a picture of the Balmain waterfront in 1942. This was basically a centre for a working class stronghold and a centre for the nation's biggest shipbuilding and repair yard. In the years following communist Ernie Thornton's election to the FIA General Secretary in 1936, the Communist Party had set about centralising the whole union apparatus in its hands. By 1943, the party controlled every FIA branch, with the exception of Balmain, represented here. 5,000 engineers and iron workers were employed at Cockatoo Island and Mort's Dock. They had a reputation for industrial militancy and fiercely resisted the centralised leadership's attempts to encroach on branch autonomy. By late 1942, a consistent opposition to the leadership emerged, led by Trotskyist Nick Oroglass and Mort Stock, and later Laurie Short at Cockatoo Island. And I don't have time really to go into the all the details of this disputation. And I mean, there are anecdotes that I could come back to, but just to say that the Communist Party was resolutely determined to oust these delegates, going as far as claiming an election victory in 1944 that was widely viewed as being fraudulent, and then in early 1945 trying to oust Oroglass and Laurie Short and replace them with party loyalists. The Balmain membership responded with total fury. A six-week strike involved 3,000 members, won not only Oroglass's reinstatement, but established a new independent branch of the FIA. And there's a whole backstory that I could talk about with the Trotskyists and their opposition to the CPA line, but that'll have to be another talk. The CPA's size and influence reached a high point in the final years of World War II. Membership rose from 4,000 in 1940, when the party was first declared illegal, to 16,000 by December 1942 and peaked at 23,000 in January 1945. According to party historian Alastair Davidson, communist union officials held sway in unions with a membership of 275,000 and had influence in unions with a membership of 480,000, 40% of all unionists. Additionally, the party made important electoral breakthroughs, such as the election of Fred Patterson to the Queensland seat of Bowen in 1944. And also communists were elected to local councils in New South Wales, particularly in coal mining towns. Communist Party veteran Laurie Ahrens observes that a remarkable sea change took place in Australian politics after the Soviet Union came into the war. He recalls that the usually anti-communist Sunday Telegraph referred to the Russian Red Army as our gallant allies. Another communist recalls the Sydney Morning Herald carrying huge articles about how good things were in the Soviet Union. And the Soviet flag was flown over Sydney Town Hall. In that picture, it's actually flown over the Sydney Post Office on a Russia Day. Celebrating Russia Day. In 1945, Stalin, on the left of this the screen there, appeared on the front cover of Women's Weekly, now admired even by media magnate Frank Packer. Communist writer Frank Hardy recalls that at this time, being a communist was as easy as a piece of cake. Three factors shaped the party's growth during this period. Firstly, despite the brutality of the Moscow trials and gulags, the Soviet Union enjoyed substantial support amongst Australian workers. It was perceived as representing a departure from the ills of capitalism, a product of the 1917 Russian Revolution, and its ultimately successful defeat of German fascism was eulogised as an example of self-sacrifice. Secondly, the Menzies government ban on the party, not lifted by Curtin until late 1942, engendered significant support for the party, whose members continued to organise underground. The party was able to trade on the authority it won in the preceding years, when communists were at the forefront of struggles by unemployed workers and later leading strikes. Finally, the party's popular front policy and its support for the war from 1941 onwards provided the party with a degree of mainstream acceptability. Whereas the majority of the party's recruits in the early years of the war were industrial workers, in the latter years of the war, middle-class recruits began to flood in. The party's legalisation and enthusiastic support for the war attracted professionals such as journalists, teachers and scientists. In 1942 to 1943, there were 48 communist journalists working on Sydney's daily newspapers. University students and intellectuals joined in large numbers. Gibson observes that these new youthful recruits joined the party on the crest of a great wave of advanced democratic sentiments, espousing a liberal democratic rather than revolutionary outlook. However, the party's period of spectacular growth proved short-lived. In the post-war years, especially after Chifley's defeat of the 1949 miners' strike and the onset of the Cold War, the party once again found itself on the margins. From its peak in early 1945, party membership fell by nearly half to 12,000 in 1947 and halved again by 1952, plateauing at 6,000. Many reasons have been cited for this decline, foremost being the party's identification with the Soviet Union. Khrushchev's denunciation of Stalin's cult of personality in 1956 revealed what many communists already knew, that Stalin's reign had seen thousands, including many former leaders of the revolution, rounded up in gulags and the democratic traditions of Bolshevism violently suppressed. And the Soviet Union's crushing of the Hungarian Revolution later that year showed that the Stalinist bureaucracy was not about to change its spots. So to conclude, over the decade of 1935 to 1945, the party grew tenfold, becoming the largest communist party in the English-speaking world relative to population. The growth accompanied a series of zigzags in its attitude to the war under directions of Moscow. In the years leading up to the war, the Popular Front line enabled it to build a significant periphery through the cultivation of anti-fascist front organisations. Additionally, communists were identified with leading working-class struggles, particularly among coal miners. Yet it was also a period in which the party began to advocate an openly class collaborationist line, campaigning not only for an alliance with Labour, but bourgeois liberals in the UAP and UCP, openly ruling class parties. The signing of the Stalin-Hitler Pact led the party to oppose the war, denouncing the crimes of the British Empire and supporting strikes, but only for a brief window. When the Soviet Union entered the war on the side of the Allied powers in June 1941, the party returned to its Popular Front line with gusto, calling for workers to make sacrifices for the Curtin government's war effort and using its influence to suppress strikes. The party's pro-war stance amounted to a complete departure from the internationalist traditions advocated by Lenin and the Bolsheviks at the time of World War I. In Australia during World War I, members of the International Workers of the World took a principled stand denouncing the war with slogans such as "War, what for?" and "One enemy, the employing class." In contrast, the CPA's promotion of World War II, an imperialist war, as a people's war and a just war, aided the Australian ruling class to win support for its war effort and undermine opposition to imperialism. And this cartoon appeared in Tribune a week after the bombing of Nagasaki on 16th of August 1945. And I should qualify it by saying that the party opposed the White Australia policy throughout and opposed the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But the fact that this cartoon was published certainly underlines that their rabid nationalism was reflected in a capitulation to anti-Japanese racism and imperialist warmongering. So not only did it support the war effort and in so doing undermine opposition to imperialism, but this supposedly good war could be evoked subsequently to justify Cold War military interventions in alliance with the United States, such as the invasions of Korea and Vietnam. Moreover, the CPA's enthusiastic embrace of a pro-war position and its open door to a layer of middle-class liberals who supported its strident nationalism made it difficult to differentiate the party from the Labor Party in this period. It didn't at any time, well, as I said, didn't support the White Australia policy, but its claim to be the leading war party and its suppression of strike action alienated the most radical and militant working class fighters, demonstrating the need to build a truly revolutionary party.